Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents John Hazlitt's World, An Ardent Patriot, The Delaware Blues, and the Spirit of 1776. By David Price. Narrated by Keith Sellenwright. War, my Lucy, is not a humane trade, and the man who follows it as such will meet with his proper demerits in another world. General Henry Knox, from a letter to his wife, Lucy Flucker Knox, January 2, 1777. Whereas, sir, you know courage is reckoned the greatest of all virtues, because unless a man has that virtue, he has no security for preserving any other. Samuel Johnson, from The Life of Samuel Johnson, LLD, by James Boswell, 1791. You cannot qualify war in harsher terms than I will. War is cruelty, and you cannot refine it. General William T. Sherman, from a letter to the mayor and city council of Atlanta, Georgia, ordering the evacuation of its inhabitants, September 12, 1864. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. President Ronald Reagan, from an address to the nation on the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger and the loss of its 7 crew members, January 28, 1986. Preface. The audiobook you're listening to represents my third venture in writing about America's war for independence from Great Britain, with a particular focus on the period from December 25, 1776, through January 3, 1777, known as the 10 crucial days of that conflict. During that time, the Continental Army, under the command of General George Washington, won its first 3 significant victories and reversed the momentum of the contest, thereby embedding this fabled winter campaign in a list of defining moments that have marked the life of a nation. The present volume represents the completion of a trilogy about what may be the 10 most inspirational days in our country's history, in that its narrative, while ranging far beyond this brief stretch of time, climaxes in the extraordinary sequence of events associated with that period. My initial literary effort culminated in Rescuing the Revolution, Unsung Patriot Heroes in the 10 Crucial Days of America's War for Independence, about a select group of largely unknown patriot stalwarts whose heroics contributed to the legendary triumphs that were part of this remarkable saga. I revisited the exploits of some of these individuals in The Road to Assunpink Creek, Liberty's Desperate Hour, and the 10 Crucial Days of the American Revolution. The work at hand takes a further step along the path laid out in the earlier titles by focusing in part on one of the individuals whose feats were highlighted therein. He was the only one of the unsung heroes portrayed in my first book to lose his life on a revolutionary battlefield, and perhaps therein lies the motivation to explore his story at greater length. I feel I owe John Hazlitt that much. There is an elegiac symmetry between his fate and that of the Delaware regiment he commanded. Both suffered through extreme adversity, and finally were lost in the struggle for a young nation's independence during the period when that cause seemed especially imperiled, and was then suddenly revived by the most remarkable military comeback in America's storied past. Unfortunately, the lack of biographical data that confronts anyone attempting to write about Hazlitt presents a very real challenge to any effort at assembling a detailed account of his life before the Revolution. Notwithstanding that impediment, this project has sought to incorporate what we do know about him into a broader historical context, particularly one that conveys an appreciation of the role he and his regiment played in an infant nation's quest for political and economic self-determination against Britain's armed might in 1776, the birth year of a political entity that ultimately gave rise to the most durable republic in history. The memory of both Hazlitt and the regiment he led would endure in the context of their service to cause and country. The initial commanding officer of Delaware's Continentals remains the individual who, to this day, is most closely identified with them, and the Delaware Blues continued to see action as a reconstituted but smaller unit after Hazlitt's death and throughout the war. Their ordeal is an integral part of the narrative surrounding a colonial uprising that triumphed over the British Empire and profoundly impacted the course of history. Introduction. This is the story of Colonel John Hazlitt and the Delaware Regiment he led during the initial, pivotal phase of our war for independence from Great Britain. It chronicles the inspirational leadership, exemplary service, and enormous sacrifice that marked their efforts on behalf of America's revolutionary enterprise. One finds no dearth of encomiums to Hazlitt's leadership from his contemporaries or in more recent accounts. He has been described as one of those Continental Army officers who were, when the chips were down, capable of delivering the best any general could demand. A warrior whose intrepidity and quickness of perception formed him for the battlefield. One of George Washington's steadiest, most reliable officers and finest regimental commanders. Beloved by his men, whom it was his pride to have exceptionally well drilled and disciplined. And an officer of seemingly unlimited ability, whose tireless efforts and efficiency made the soldiers under his command some of the best disciplined and drilled in Washington's army. He was charismatic, inspirational, and eloquent, someone who persuaded men to sign on to the newly formed army with his strong convictions and inspired loyalty and excellence among his recruits, a firm friend to his country, an ardent patriot, redoubtable, indefatigable, and unconquerable. And in the end, he met a hero's death on the Princeton battlefield. Had he lived long enough, it seems clear that Hazlitt would have been promoted to Brigadier General in the Continental Army, and the fact that he was not accorded that recognition apparently resulted from political considerations. In awarding such promotions, the Continental Congress took into account an officer's state of residence in the interest of encouraging support for the war effort among its governing officials and the inhabitants thereof. Unfortunately, a state as small as Delaware lacked the necessary political influence in Congress to secure the colonel's long overdue and well-deserved advancement. A comparable litany of praise is in evidence for those Hazlitt led, as they comprised one of the most distinguished regiments under Washington's command. They were widely esteemed for their bravery and military skill, and, unlike many other units in the ragtag rebel army of 1776, looked and acted like real soldiers who were well-equipped and well-disciplined. These men created an impressive sight in their stylish uniforms, added a much-needed dash of professionalism to Washington's force, and stood up exceedingly well in battle. Known for their courage, hardihood, and military efficiency second to none in the Continental Army, the Delaware contingent was thought to be one of its two best units, along with William Smallwood's Maryland Regiment, with whom the Delaware soldiers often fought side by side. Indeed, the heroic stand by these two regiments at the Battle of Long Island in August 1776 reportedly prompted their observing commander-in-chief to laud them as his brave fellows. There was ample reason for the Delaware and Maryland soldiers to be regarded as the elite of Washington's army, for they fought their way into legend at Long Island and throughout the war. In his classic study of the Delaware Continental service during the War for Independence, written more than three-quarters of a century ago, the historian Christopher Ward observes that John Hazlitt is one of those who have been singled out of the multitude of revolutionary regimental officers for especial commendation by all who have recorded the military events of those 7 years, and that his name seldom appears in such chronicles without being preceded by an adjective of laudation. Ward is as eloquent in his tribute to the soldiers whom Hazlitt and those who succeeded him led into battle, that is, the 1st Delaware Regiment and the unit that took its place after Hazlitt's death, describing them as a force to be reckoned with, even when few in number. Forged on the anvil of hardship under the hammer of experience, he writes, the Delaware Regiment was a weapon which any of the great captains of history would have been glad to launch at his foe. It is not too much to say that no other single regiment in the American Army had a longer and more continuous term of service, marched more miles, suffered greater hardships, fought in more battles, or achieved greater distinction than this one of Delaware. In his acclaimed mid-19th century biography of George Washington, the noted author and essayist Washington Irving opined that Hazlitt distinguished himself throughout the 1776 campaign by being among the foremost in services of danger. He was indeed a gallant officer, and gallantly seconded by his Delaware troops. The accolades earned by Hazlitt and his regiment convey a sense of how superlative their service was during the adversity of 1776, when Washington, staggered by one defeat after another, attempted to survive the onslaught of a militarily superior foe and carry on the revolution against what appeared to be truly daunting odds. At the same time, the standard of excellence that these Delawares set, and the inspiring example they provided for the rest of the Continental Army, put into stark perspective the extent of their sacrifice, and made all the more harrowing the demise of that unit, including its commanding officer, before it was replaced by a reconstituted Delaware regiment in 1777. The story of these men is one that deserves an honored place in the annals of American military history, and reminds us of how great a cost was incurred in the struggle to achieve our independence and lay the foundation for a new country. That same price has been paid by the nation's finest at many times and on many fields since. In doing so, they have added to a roll of honor that stretches back to the American Revolution and began with those resolute comrades in arms, like the Delaware colonel and the members of his regiment, who dreamed of a free and independent America and contended fiercely for it. John Hazlitt's kind are not ranked in the annals of history with the likes of our founding fathers, and his name will never be extolled in the manner accorded such iconic figures as Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and Franklin. He was no giant, but to his generation, men like Hazlitt loomed large indeed, for they carried on their sturdy backs the quest for political and economic autonomy and national sovereignty against the British Empire. Some, like Hazlitt, were forced by unyielding circumstances to pass that effort on to others who saw it through to completion. And the men of his regiment set an example for other Continental Army units to follow and, in the process, carved a place for themselves in revolutionary lore. Part 1. A New Beginning. May you find what you're seeking wherever you roam. Irish Blessing. 1. Ireland. The morning of January 3rd, 1777, was a bitterly cold one in Princeton, New Jersey. Colonel John Hazlitt found himself on a frozen battlefield with the other soldiers of George Washington's Continental Army, who had faced one hardship after another, both before and during their grueling winter campaign, in pursuit of a young nation's quest for independence from Great Britain. Hazlitt would have been able to see his breath in the frigid air as the British soldiers and their colonial counterparts engaged in yet another clash of arms, and with his last exhalation, he attempted to rouse his fellow countrymen to stand against their advancing foe. In that moment, this Irish immigrant's American journey came to a sudden and violent end. The wrath of fate that created an abrupt encounter between an enemy bullet and a lion-hearted colonel achieved a cruel outcome, but perhaps one befitting his tireless efforts to inspire those around him in a cause for which he was willing to make the most extreme sacrifice. John Hazlitt's transatlantic journey began around 1757, when he was about 30 years of age, after arriving in British North America from his native Ireland. He was born circa 1728, but the exact date is unknown. having most likely departed from the port of Londonderry in the northern Irish province of Ulster and travelled with one of his brothers, Hazlitt landed at Philadelphia, the largest city in the American colonies. A large man, he has been described as a tough, burly Irishman, who was erect and athletic, and over 6 feet tall, lean, muscular, and very handsome. Like his birth date, Hazlitt's exact image has not been confirmed by any visual evidence, as there is no known representation of him by an 18th-century artist. This author can cite only two illustrations that include an image of Hazlitt, both of which envelop his figure in a scene teeming with soldiers, one a parade and the other a battle. The Drumbeat of a Nation, 1915, by Stanley Arthurs, 1877-1950, the original of which hangs in the Delaware Public Archives building, shows the colonel at the head of his regiment as it departed from the Dover Green in Dover, Delaware, for Philadelphia in July 1776, on its way to join the Continental Army. The other painting was completed at an unknown date, but probably in the 1850s, by George Washington Parke Custis, 1781-1857, George Washington's step-grandson and adopted son, which depicts the deaths of Hazlitt and General Hugh Mercer at the Battle of Princeton on January 3, 1777. Neither artist ever saw Hazlitt in person or, as far as we know, had a visual record of the man upon which to base his illustration. In each case, the colonel's appearance springs full-blown from the artist's imagination. The type of voyage that John Hazlitt undertook to America in the mid-18th century was an ordeal at best, assuming the ship made it across 3,000 miles of ocean during a journey that would have lasted at least 8 to 10 weeks. On average, each vessel that crossed the Atlantic conveyed between 120 and 140 people who brought along whatever personal possessions they could carry to their new home. They had to endure overcrowded conditions in cramped quarters that were often not designed for passengers and could be a breeding ground for smallpox, typhus, and other infectious diseases, for the Irish and British authorities placed no restrictions on the number of passengers allowed in relation to berth space. The voyagers spent much of their time below deck, which made for a wretched passage due to the lack of ventilation and portholes to provide air in these emigration vessels. That the waterway they were crossing was noted for the severity of its weather, including intense storms, underscores the reality of a risky, terrifying, and dangerous trip, even for those who felt they had little to lose. It is thought that Hazlitt's forebears came to Scotland from the Netherlands in the 17th century or earlier, perhaps directly or after spending some time in England. One might speculate that they were fleeing Spanish rule in the Netherlands, but their motive for relocating is unknown. After residing in Scotland for a period, they arrived in Ulster, the traditional name for the northern part of Ireland, which is derived from the ancient tribe of Ulaid that populated northeastern Ireland in the early Christian period. The Hazlitts would have been part of a wave of Scottish newcomers who moved there by the thousands during the 1600s to take advantage of land that was much more fertile than at home and to escape a backward economy. This movement was part of the Ulster Plantation, an effort organized by the British Crown to colonize Northern Ireland with English and Scottish settlers on lands confiscated from the native Irish. Between 1690 and 1697 alone, an estimated 50,000 Scots arrived in Ireland, and most made their homes in Ulster. The average Scot at that time lived a life of poverty and hardship. Plus, a new system of land tenure after 1610 dispossessed many Scottish farmers of their acreage and forced them to hire out their labor, all of which made the prospect of a new life in Ireland attractive. The character of these immigrants, shaped by the adversity of prior grim economic circumstances, facilitated their endeavor to establish a new home for themselves in Northern Ireland. The transplanted Scots built towns, villages, churches, and schools, cleared the land, drained the marshes, and enclosed the fields, raised farm horses, and established homesteads. They proved to be stubborn, tough, resilient, and hard-working, the same qualities their descendants later exhibited in America during the next great Scotch-Irish migration in the 1700s. The overwhelming majority of the Scotch-Irish residents of Ulster were Presbyterians, and John Hazlitt was born into a Presbyterian family in the village of Straw, located in the Roe Valley between Dungiven and Limavady, within County Londonderry in Ulster. The name of his birthplace was derived from the Irish word sra, meaning wide valley. Hazlitt's parents were Joseph, a merchant and tenant farmer, and Anne Dykes Hazlitt. John's grandfather, the Reverend James Dykes of Moneymore, was ordained at Mahera, also in County Londonderry, in 1720, and served as a Presbyterian minister until his death in 1734. After John, Joseph and Anne would have five other children, Anne, James, Joseph, Mary, and William. Joseph Hazlitt's income apparently supported his large family to the extent that he could afford to provide at least one of his children with a university education, an opportunity available to a relative few at this time. As the eldest son, John was afforded that privilege when he attended the prestigious University of Glasgow in Scotland, the fourth oldest university in the English-speaking world, after completing his early education in Ulster. Founded in 1451, Glasgow is one of Scotland's four ancient universities, along with Edinburgh, Aberdeen, and St. Andrews. Irish students such as Hazlitt symbolized and reflected the close relationship that had existed for centuries between their native land and Scotland. Their coasts are separated by a mere 12 miles at the narrowest point in the North Channel, as part of a vast cultural sea which experienced a continuous intermingling of its people and a sharing of traditions. In the early 18th century, the student population at the University of Glasgow was about 400. Students entered as boys, sometimes as young as age 10. The majority were sons of ministers, burgesses, and farmers, along with a smaller number from the nobility and gentry. Students had classes and disputations, debates, every weekday and Saturday, and attended church together on Sunday. Undergraduate arts students, comprising the majority, were required to wear a scarlet gown that made them a distinctive sight within the small provincial town, and they were expected to carry a Bible and speak Latin when in the company of other students. From its inception, the university was empowered to grant degrees in arts and the higher faculties of divinity, law, and medicine. However, in its earliest years, teaching was largely confined to arts and theology, reflecting the demands of the students and the university's close association with the local cathedral. Until the early 1700s, the university primarily educated young men for a career in the ministry. Despite the Crown's attempts to suppress the Presbyterian Church in favor of the establishment Anglican Church, the number of Presbyterian congregations continued to expand. The Scottish universities were the training ground for Presbyterian clergy, whom the Church stipulated must be university graduates. The requirement created a problem for congregations in Ireland and the American colonies, among whom the demand for ministers exceeded the available supply, given the small number of universities then in existence. At Glasgow, John Hazlitt studied to become a Presbyterian minister and in 1749 earned a Master of Arts degree in Divinity, which was an undergraduate degree, after completing a rigorous 5-year course of study that included Latin, Greek, logic, moral philosophy, and natural philosophy, physics, or mathematics. In addition, he may have taken classes in physic, a term then applied to the medical arts or healing profession, and associated with the use of purgative medicinal agents or preparations. Armed with this credential, the new graduate was licensed by the Derry Presbytery in 1750 and ordained a Presbyterian minister at Ballykelly County, Londonderry, on April 21, 1752. In about 1750, Hazlitt married Shirley Stirling, daughter of the Reverend Stirling, who served the Presbyterian parish at Ballykelly as minister from 1699 until his death on January 21, 1752. Shirley bore a daughter, Mary, who became known as Polly, in about 1752, but the young mother most likely died in childbirth. Polly was raised by her uncle, Samuel Hazlitt, and would journey across the Atlantic in about 1765 to reunite with her father. The latter had served the church in Ballykelly for 5 years when he decided to go to America. It is possible that the emotional impact of Shirley's death jolted the young cleric's faith to such an extent that it impaired his ability to perform his ministerial duties. This, in turn, may have adversely affected his relations with members of the congregation, particularly regarding their inclination to meet his financial needs, and precipitated, or at least contributed, to his decision to leave the Emerald Isle and start over in a new land. The Derry Presbytery ultimately determined that the congregation was in arrears to the departed minister, whose father pursued a resolution of this matter on his son's behalf for several years, and enforced payment of the debt. Another factor may have influenced the young clergyman's relocation as much or more than purely personal considerations. Religious oppression. After the black slaves who were brought to North America's shores by force from Africa and the West Indies, the largest non-English group of immigrants arriving in the 1700s were the Scotch-Irish, the Ulstermen from Northern Ireland, such as John Hazlitt. Their exodus stemmed from changes in English rule that occurred in the wake of the Glorious Revolution of 1688. A variety of circumstances motivated the flight from Ulster. The English Parliament, carefully protective of Anglicans, led its Irish counterpart to bar Presbyterians from all civil and military offices under the Crown, and to remove those holding posts as judges and postmasters. More galling, perhaps, were the taxes the Presbyterians were forced to pay to the Church of England. These hardships might have been endured by most Irish, except that the economic hardship imposed by English policy that discriminated against wool, cattle, and linen from Ireland drove many who were poor, desperate, or just adventurous to begin leaving for the New World. These grievances contributed to a widespread disenchantment that fueled a growing willingness among many Scotch-Irish to risk the lengthy and hazardous ocean voyage of transatlantic emigration. The specific sources of this discontent included the Test Act of 1704, alluded to earlier, which excluded Presbyterians from the military, the civil service, and teaching, restrictions on Irish trade with other English colonies, the Woolens Act of 1699 that limited the export of Irish wool to only England or Wales, and soaring rents charged by landowners, many of them absentee English landlords. In addition, the forces of nature seemingly conspired to push the Scotch-Irish to leave Ireland's shores by the thousands in the early 18th century, a six-year-long drought beginning in 1714, which ruined crops and devastated small farms, the disease called rot that killed large numbers of sheep, and a deadly smallpox outbreak in Ulster in 1718. The departure of 1,000 people in 10 ships from Northern Ireland to Boston in 1718 set an example for others to follow, as the trickle soon became a flood. It began a continuous tide of emigration, comprised overwhelmingly of Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, which continued unabated until the American Revolution erupted. For many, the point of departure was one of the fine main ports of Ulster: Londonderry, Portrush, Belfast, Larne, and Newry, although some sailed from the southern ports of Dublin, Drogheda, and Sligo. By 1728, the migration was up to 3,000 people annually. In one 15-year period, 3% of Scotland's population and nearly as many Irish left for America. A stream of letters home from those who made it across the Atlantic encouraged friends and relatives to join the newcomers, touting the advantages of their new life. These included land that was affordable and plentiful, laws that gave certain legal rights to those immigrants who entered into indentured servitude, freedom from religious restrictions, and economic opportunity for those inclined to hard work. The English-speaking ability of the Scotch-Irish immigrants gave them a considerable advantage over newcomers from the various German states who also arrived in America in significant numbers during the 18th century. In Delaware, the former's rapid progress is indicated by the fact that among the immigrants were John McKinley, the first chief executive of the state of Delaware, William Killen, the first chancellor, and John Hazlitt, the first commander of the Delaware Regiment in George Washington's army. Ultimately,
sample complete. Ready to continue?